I'm Brian Karam, and I've spent decades covering politics. Now I'm taking you behind the scenes, one interview at a time.
Join us as each week Brian confronts the issues that matter, posing the questions you wish you could ask. No filter, no agenda, just the truth.
We're not here for sound bites. We're here for substance. Join me, Brian Karam, every week as we cut through the noise and get straight to it. This is Just Ask the Question, where curiosity will lead us to the facts.
Subscribe now on your favorite podcast platform. And remember, when you want answers, all you have to do is just ask the question.
MSW Media.
Spy Talk, a podcast at the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, national security, and military operations.
Hi there, I'm Jeff Stein.
I'm Michael Isgoff.
And I'm Karen Greenberg.
And this is Spy Talk. As usual, lots going on in our corner of the national security world. And everyone talking today, of course, about the assassination, as it's called, of Charlie Kirk. Now, you might not think that this is Spy Talk material, but actually it is. I'm thinking that this is also 9/11, which was a hinge moment in American history. Country changed a lot domestically in terms of its approach to terrorism and so on. And in the wind with the Charlie Kirk assassination is another hinge moment in American history. Karen, you are an expert on national security, civil liberties, and so on and so forth, with several books under your belt. What's your take on what's going on right now?
Well, first of all, my take on this is an incredibly sad moment for the United States, and one in which it's hard to figure out what the next step forward is so that we don't go further down the line of violence and destruction and fear. But I do think, and thank you for pointing to the fact that today is 9/11 and the anniversary of the attacks from 2001, and sort of very aware of the fact of how much the conversation and the focus of what our security is about has really come home to roost and from within our own. I think what happened in Utah is worth looking at from a number of different angles. One, of course, is how can we make ourselves safe as Americans? But the other one is, to what extent is the amount of anger on both sides and across the political spectrum actually so intense that violence doesn't seem to be able to be deterred? What would it take to deter that kind of violence? And while I think we need to do an investigation, obviously, into what happened, I think the question that's on the table right now is, what can we do that's constructive? Because we're a country that is devolving into violence. And this violence seems to be happening in sort of one-offs. We're not sure how organized any of this is. We may never know. But look, Pelosi event where her husband was hammered in the head, to the assassination of the minister, House Speaker Melissa Hartman and her husband, and the shooting of the state senator and his wife, Luigi Mangione. We've seen all different kinds of, in the political spectrum, in the public space, in the private space, what is happening to our country? And how do we stop it? How many guns are out there? How many guns of people with an anger that is uncontrollable with mental illness are there out there? Can we address this as a society or not? And this is a challenge that, rather than finding a way to approach and to address, we've just dropped the ball. And I think that when you think about the fact that 9/11 happened 24 years ago, and that was so pivotal to how it changed our view of the world, that this is another moment. And the other side of this that's worth thinking about is, what will this mean going forward for Americans and carrying out their lives? What does this moment mean? And I think we have that's something we have to await in terms of further violence or somebody who can step up and provide leadership to take us in the other direction.
Mike, you just wrote a very important story about the 9/11 investigation and questions about was the ball dropped by the FBI and the Justice Department. And we're going to keep on that story. The FBI is, of course, very much involved in the Charlie Kirk investigation. So I wonder what you see in terms of the FBI going forward. And it's in such a disheveled place right now.
Right,
You talked to an FBI official who was fired.
Yep.
In a political purge when you were at a conference in New York yesterday. Tell us about that.
Yeah. Both Karen and I were at the Soufan Center's annual global summit on counterterrorism, which is held just by at Ground Zero by the World Trade Towers, you know, where they were. And it's often very emotional because you get a lot of family members of people who were killed on 9/11, firefighters, cops, people who fought and tried to save people, first responders. I got to say, there was a sort of star there who everybody had their eyes on, and that was Brian Driscoll, who was for a while the acting director of the FBI, was fired by Kash Patel a month or so ago, and he was widely beloved. I actually did meet him for the first time. Holding court at a bar right by World Trade Center, where all the FBI guys were there. And I offered to buy. I said, probably you probably don't have to buy your own drinks anymore. Everybody's buying for you. He said, I insist on buying my own drinks. Mm-hmm. He was like, by the book to the core. And I say all that because we have the exact opposite at the leadership of the FBI, and it's laid out in this extraordinary lawsuit that Driscoll and two others who were fired by Kash Patel just filed against Patel, Pam Bondi, the White House, and what they lay out chapter and verse with very specific details about just how politicized the Bureau has become. And I'll just offer you just a few examples from that lawsuit because they're kind of mind-blowing. When Driscoll is first up for getting a top, he already has top jobs at the FBI. He was the special agent in charge of Newark. He'd been in charge of the hostage rescue team. He had multiple jobs, but he was being vetted for a very top job by a young kid at the White House, at the Trump White House. This is shortly after Trump's inauguration. And here are some of the questions that Driscoll is being asked by this young MAGA kid at the White House. Who did you vote for? Do you agree that the FBI agents who stormed Mar-a-Lago to include the rank and file should be held accountable? What are your thoughts on DEI? When did you start supporting President Trump? Have you voted for a Democrat in the last five elections?
Totally inappropriate.
And Driscoll refused to answer those questions. He just wouldn't answer.
Right. And the essence of the lawsuit is challenging the lack of independence between the White House and the Department of Justice.
Oh, correct? Yeah. I mean, they specific examples. And then when Patel is firing Driscoll or on the eve of firing him, he makes clear what's going on here, and I'll just give you this. This is on or about August 6th in a conversation with Driscoll. Patel plainly states the reason behind his firing of FBI employees that Driscoll sought to defend, and that was the sort of backdrop for this. Patel had a bunch of people he wanted fired, including his own pilot, Chris Meyer, because the MAGA crowd on social media had been saying he was somehow involved in investigations of Trump, and therefore, what's he doing flying the FBI director around? And so Driscoll tells, Patel tells Driscoll, he admits that they wanted him to fire. He had been directed to fire anyone who they identified as having worked on criminal investigations against Trump. He's clear who they is. Driscoll understood that to be the White House or the Department of Justice. And then when Driscoll pushes back, Patel says there's nothing he or Driscoll could do to stop these or any other firings because, quote, the FBI tried to put the president in jail and he hasn't forgotten it. So the fact that this is revenge for Donald mm-hmm. Trump to go after everybody in the FBI who investigated him is crystal clear in this lawsuit.
And we're going to hear a lot more about it because it is in court now. So that's going to drag out for some time. But we not only have the injection of a poison of partisan politics in the FBI, but there's a real question of incompetence at the very top. Patel stumbled right out of the gate with the Charlie Kirk case.
Right.
You know, putting out an announcement or
said he had a suspect when they didn't have a suspect.
And they didn't have a suspect. And the FBI prides itself on being very circumspect in these cases of investigations by normal procedure. It's the local FBI official who makes the initial pronouncements on the state of the investigation, so on and so forth. And it's not the FBI director saying, "We got the guy." It turns out to be wrong.
Yeah.
So, this is, you know, this raises the issue that we've touched on from time to time, back pretty regularly over the many months, is the general incompetence that we're seeing in intelligence agencies. And this is maybe far afield from what we're talking about with the Charlie Kirk case and the FBI and Driscoll and firing, politicization of firings. But a case was surfaced last week about a failed Navy SEAL raid on North Korea. And I don't know how this was green-lighted and what kind of deliberative process they went through. But the idea of sending Navy SEALs to swim in ashore in North Korea, an incredible police state, they end up shooting a bunch of innocent fishermen. They don't plant the listening device that they were sent to send. And you got to wonder, like, we have NSA, we've got all sorts of technologies to intercept North Korean communication. You wonder why the Trump administration was sending in a SEAL team, like a bunch of cowboys, to plant a listening device on the beach. I mean, that just doesn't make any sense to me at all. And this is just the latest chapter of problems with the Navy SEALs, I might point out. They've had discipline problems, training problems, drug problems, et cetera, et cetera. So we're going to keep an eye on that. But
before we go, I just have one more scene from the lawsuit that I want to mention, because it sort of gets to your issue of competence. And this is just 10 days into Trump's presidency. Driscoll and one of his colleagues go to Patel and tell him what they're doing, because it's already clear they want these mass purge. They've asked for, you know, Patel's asked for the names. The Justice Department has asked for the names of everybody who was involved in investigations of Donald Trump, and Driscoll's refusing to give it. Driscoll and a colleague go to Emil Bove at that point, who's the Justice Department enforcer overseeing the FBI, and they warn him that what they're doing in threatening these mass purges is, quote, stoking panic and anxiety within federal law enforcement. And what's Bove's response? Creating panic and anxiety, according Bove said, according to this lawsuit,
God,
was the intent. That was the purpose of what they were doing, to create panic and anxiety within the FBI.
Yeah, so, what we have now is chaos.
Right.
Back to the shadow world is our meat and potatoes.
Yep.
Our guests today, two top investigative reporters from the Wall Street Journal, Drew Hinshaw and Joe Parkinson, have written an extraordinarily fascinating book about secret hostage diplomacy between the U.S. and Russia. It's called SWAP: A Secret History of the New Cold War, and I am absolutely confident that you are going to really enjoy listening to them on the Spy Talk podcast. Drew Hinshaw and Joe Parkinson, welcome to Spy Talk. I just loved your book, SWAP: A Secret History of the Cold War. Now, it is a history of a certain kind of Cold War, but it's really a string of rollicking spy stories that hang on a thread of these secret negotiations between Russia and the United States over hostages. There's this one fascinating spy story after another. The thing that's interesting here is that what you really establish is that taking hostages is a Kremlin policy. Tell us about that and how that began.
Well, this began for us in a pretty personal way. On March 29th, a couple years ago, we were out to dinner at a Polish restaurant in Warsaw, actually, about to meet the Polish president the next morning. And another Wall Street Journal reporter asks, have you heard from Evan? He was referring to Evan Gershkovich, our colleague who covered Russia, a fantastic, intrepid reporter. And we learned in the morning that Evan had been not just detained, not just jailed, but brought to Lefortovo, this fortress where Stalin used to have political dissidents tortured. And he had been charged with espionage, the first American reporter so charged in Moscow since the Cold War, since the
Soviet era. You didn't know at that point that he had been taken. You just noted that he had been missing, hadn't been heard from for some time. There was no announcement by the Kremlin.
That's that right. There was him. Hours of silence. We were trying everybody we could, every reporter in the journal who had some connection. We had reporters connecting to random taxi drivers in Yekaterinburg and local journalists there. We had our DC bureau chief, the great Paul Beckett, dialing Antony Blinken. We were riling up the National Security Council, getting everyone in Washington alarmed, trying to connect with the Russian ambassador to DC, anything we could. But you're right, at that point, this was a case of a missing person. You don't know, right? Was there some kind of horrible accident? But in the morning, it was very clear, this is something else. This is an escalation by the Kremlin against the American media. And the question for us was, well, what did it mean? Why? Why did they do this? And kind of like, who in the Russian system did this?
Mm-hmm. Now, Joe, there's an interesting cast of characters. You think that these hostage negotiations would just involve officials in Moscow and in Washington, but actually, quoting from your book, these swaps involved, and particularly the climax of your book with a swap of some 16 Kremlin prisoners to the U.S. and notable Russian prisoners in the U.S. It involved, quote, billionaires, world leaders, celebrities, and spy chiefs who had invested years into a trade so complicated that diplomats nicknamed it the Rubik's Cube.
This was really, as Drew said, such a personal story. The story sort of chose us rather than us choosing the story. But what we didn't realize as we started to peel back the layers of those simple questions like who took Evan was that we would find these layers upon layers of secret worlds. Like you said, when you think about mediation or hostage diplomacy, you probably think about diplomats or maybe even intelligence officers in a room, you know, maybe with a list and talking about doing difficult trades. And that is one aspect of this. And because this has become such a bigger problem for the US has had to increase the infrastructure and the number of people who are doing this, but also operating in this world are some of the most unbelievable characters, as you say, people who operate in the shadows, people that you wouldn't necessarily, think would people, some of the most famous people or influential people in the world who are ferrying messages, working as back channel mediators, meeting Russian spies in places as exotic as Monte Carlo in a white Rolls Royce. We did not expect when we started this book that we would be diving into something that felt just like Ian Fleming and John le Carré, but somehow totally, totally real. And it was an incredible, incredible experience to report on it and learn it.
So just picking up on, you know, where we started with the abduction of your colleague, Evan Gershkovich, you raise the question of why, and you essentially give the answer. Putin wanted a certain individual being held in prison in Germany released in exchange for this Wall Street Journal reporter. Now, unlike your colleague, who was a journalist, this guy in Germany had a very different background. Tell us who he was and why Putin wanted him released so badly.
Well, as far as the immigration authorities at Warsaw's airport where he landed in 2019 were concerned, his name was Vadim Sokolov. And he checked into the Novotel and got himself a manicure and tipped the receptionist very nicely and asked her to hold his room for 5 days. And then he goes to Berlin and he murdered. He rode, pedals a bicycle up in the Kleiner Tiergarten Park in central Berlin, the heart of the German capital. And he murders an exile, a Chechen man.
In broad daylight.
At noon, almost exactly yes. noon. And yeah. in front of a coffee shop called All You Need Is Love. And there were probably clues that this wasn't an ordinary murder. He gets on his bike and he drives down the one street that has no security cameras. He goes to a little river, the Spree, that actually used to separate East and West Berlin. And he's frantically changing out of his clothes. He's throwing his wig in the ocean, in the river, dumping his bike in the river. When two 17-year-old boys say, this guy looks weird, and they call the police, and the police show up, and he's relieving himself into a bush when the police arrest him. And the thing they say in their police report is that Vadim Sokolov looked unusually calm, as if he knew something they didn't when they arrested him. He didn't resist.
It's a cinematic scene.
Yeah. So just to be clear, like, so he was FSB, SVR?
Well, nobody knew. And then they go into the courtroom, and this guy shows up. He's called Witness G. He's a Bulgarian journalist. They don't say his name. They just court refers to him as Witness G. And he proceeds to give testimony that this guy named Vadim Sokolov, there's something about his past that doesn't make sense. First of all, he appears nowhere in any Russian database until he's in his late 40s. No car wreck, no police incident, no rental property, no trace of his existence until he's in his late 40s. His passport is marked special person protected by law. And this Witness G proceeds to say that his name is not Vadim Sokolov. His name is Vadim Krasikov, and he is, with all likelihood, an officer in the FSB.
That's just one of the factors that's so interesting about your book, that this Bulgarian journalist played such a key role in hostage location and negotiations.
But I just want to just go back. The relationship with Putin.
Yes.
Because, I mean, you say these guys, Putin was friends with this FSB assassin. They went to the shooting range together. They had a long relationship, and Putin wanted him freed.
And Putin was trying everything to get him back.
And in a way, this conclusion materialized as we went through the reporting, and our reporting tracked what was dawning on the State Department and the National Security Council as well about this individual. So at the CIA, they puzzled over exactly how close Krasikov was to Putin. Yes, he went to the shooting range. Can you imagine the kind of security it would take to go to the shooting range with Vladimir Putin? You can't even sit on a table with Vladimir Putin unless you're, you know, kind of half a kilometer away. He would have had to have been so high ranking, so deeply vetted. And a number of analysts inside the CIA believe that Krasikov was actually Putin's personal bodyguard. If that's true, that obviously raises huge questions about the fact that he was also deployed abroad, and Berlin wasn't his first operation, to assassinate some of the most important opponents of the Kremlin and of Putin himself. And as we saw when the spies, you know, who were exchanged for the Americans landed in Moscow, Vladimir Putin, who doesn't even go to the airport to greet some of the most important world leaders who visit Russia, was walking on the red carpet nervously like a schoolboy with two bouquets of flowers waiting to meet these individuals. They are really so, so important to him. There's something emotional and sentimental, which is a word you don't hear very often associated with Vladimir Putin, about these individuals. And when Krasikov came off the plane, he was greeted first. That was a clear choreography to show their importance, I think, to the Kremlin. Putin gave him a hug and we had it translated and the lips read. And he basically says, like, what's up, man? It's very familiar. They knew each other. We might never know quite how close they were, but they were close.
Yeah, but just one last question on this. I mean, I followed the reporting on Gershkovich and his abduction, but it wasn't clear to me until reading your book just how closely connected it was to Putin's desire to get this FSB assassin freed in Germany. Was that, when did it become clear that how connected those two
almost immediately.
Were?
In fact, it was so clear that there was a reporter in the Wall Street Journal who kept telling us, hey man, we should do a story on Putin's hostage diplomacy. He reached out to our German correspondent to say, hey, Putin is really trying to get this Vadim Krasikov guy out of his German jail cell. That reporter was Evan. It was clear, I think, to the Journal within a week or two that this is what it was going to take to free Evan. It was clear to us as reporters, and it was nauseating, I think, for everybody involved, because as you said earlier, all of these people, Evan, that's a journalist. There were other people, other journalists like Vladimir Karamurza in Russian prisons. These people were doing honorable work, and Putin was trying to trade them for someone who had crossed the most heinous moral threshold imaginable.
Karen?
Yeah, so I want to focus a little bit on what went on within the United States, you know, the State Department, the National Security Council. I mean, two of the main players in the book are Jake Sullivan and Roger Carstens, and they're not always on the same page in terms of what to do. And so I wondered if you could talk a little bit, and I'll have some follow-up questions, but talk a little bit about how Carstens had his own agenda, his own way of doing things. And when you mentioned before the personal element and how important that was, just sort of how it played out that all of the politics being there, his work with the families and the way that played such an important role, if it did, which is how I took it away from your book, such an important role in how this story eventually came to some kind of resolution.
Well, just on the families, I think, you know, this is a book clearly that reveals a secret world where there are celebrities, world leaders, all of these people mediating. But honestly, the heart and soul of the book really are the ordinary American families who are thrust into this world, who otherwise would have had no idea that their loved one, their son, their brother, was a pawn in a new chapter of great power competition. And those individuals had to navigate through an often very difficult and opaque and Byzantine US bureaucracy to try to find the right people who would be able to advocate for them and try and get their loved ones basically on a list or to the top of the list. And Roger Carstens is this kind of incredible character, you know, former Green Beret, you know, saw action of some kind in 6 or 7 wars. I can't quite remember it. And, you know, went back to university to sort of study, you know, Greek philosophy and great literature, and saw himself, I think, as a sort of soldier scholar who was almost had a mission, really, to work with the families with one goal, which was just get these individuals home. And he had come to a conclusion about Russia and Putin, which was that Putin was going to carry on taking Americans until he got what he wanted, which in this case was Krasikov, and then they could clear the decks and work on deterrence. Jake Sullivan, who was in charge of the Russia file, and was dealing with, I think, a much more complicated sort of matrix of problems and looking at the Russia file and the hostage situation in the context of all of these other very dynamic problems that he was trying to solve. How many missiles to give to the Ukrainians? You know, how to deal with Putin threatening tactical nuclear weapons. He had, I think, had a different view, which is, and he was also trying to balance, I suppose, the moral hazard of what happens if you keep giving Putin what he wants, particularly as Putin keeps escalating from spies to arms dealers in the case of Viktor Boot up to murderer in the case of Krasikov.
Well, one of the things that comes through, though, in your book is that Carstens is continually frustrated by the White House and frustrated by the pace at which they're doing things. Not that they're not paying attention, they are. And this all comes to a head, of course, with what happens to Navalny. Do you think that was a pivotal point in getting the White House to say, okay, maybe we do have to really go more rapidly about this, take this, you know, but because it put them back to square one in many ways. So could you just talk about both the pace and how they were thinking about it differently, but also about the pivot point of Navalny?
I think what's really happening here is the collapse of the no concessions policy, which guided America's approach to kidnappings since Richard Nixon. And obviously there were exceptions like the Iran hostage crisis in the 80s. or 79. But the key point is that by the time we get to 2023, 2024, Roger Carstens represents this part of the government that says, look, you're going to pay a ransom anyway. Do it. The sooner you do it, the better for everybody. And the White House, the Biden White House, understandably, is trying to drive the best bargain they can. They've got to look the American people in the eye and say, yes, we're giving up this terrible guy for an American citizen, but we got the best deal we ever were going to get. And that is a, I think that's the last step of no concessions ending. And so the person who becomes really important in this is Alexei Navalny, who is, of course, this Russia's most famous dissident, a symbol of the very, very thin, if not gone, hope that Russia could become a liberal democracy after the fall of communism. And he, getting him out would have satisfied the Germans, who, after all, are the ones who are holding Vadim Krasikov, this murderer, and have to release him. It would have also allowed the White House to go in front of America and the world and say, yes, we're giving up some bad hombres to get people like Evan and Vladimir Karamurza back. But look, we're also saving this dissident who represents a brighter future for Russia. And I think the White House came on board. The White House was getting there. By January of 2024, they were basically there. By February, I think on February 7th, thereabouts, maybe 9th, somewhere in there, they meet Olaf Scholz, Chancellor of Germany, meets Joe Biden. They agree to pursue this plan. And then a week later, Navalny dies.
Can you just fill us in this about the
role? Tell us how Navalny died.
Thank you.
His death takes place. Let's go to Munich for a second. It's the Munich Annual Security Forum. Happens every year. It's the forum where Putin in 2007 walks out on the stage and launches this diatribe that takes everyone by surprise and basically says, we don't want to live in a world with one master, one sovereign. America's gone too far. It's an empire now. We refuse. It's that forum, but now it's obviously 2024. And Kamala Harris is flying in. She's going to meet the Slovenians who've got a couple spies that they're going to free. FBI Director Christopher Wray is there. Tony Blinken, the Secretary of State's there. Roger Carstens isn't supposed to be there, but is kind of there. And they all have this goal of getting this exchange to happen. And it's about noon, about lunchtime. And actually, Chris Wray, the FBI director, and a whole bunch of other intelligence and law enforcement officials and leaders from out the Western Alliance are sitting around a table, and their phones buzz, and Navalny has died. And what's striking to me about that is that morning, Putin in Russia is giving a tour of a defense factory, and he looks just positively giddy. He's shifting in his chair. You can see his cheeks barely suppressing a smile. And it's kind of everyone's hopes in the U.S. for a big prisoner trade that would free Navalny have just been completely dashed.
Including our own, I should say, and this was another very personal kind of experience in terms of the reporting, because we had known this. You know, our job, Drew and I, as the investigations unit for Foreign News of the Journal, was try and find out everything about what happened to Evan, the institutions that are responsible for taking him. Let's try and do stories that hold them accountable while not doing him harm, which is a very difficult kind of tightrope to walk. But in that case, we knew that this trade was coming together. We had stories already written, ready to go, saying Evan Gershkovich is free in an exchange, you know, with Alexei Navalny for Vadim Krasikov. And so this was also a huge gut punch for us as an institution and us personally. And Drew and I, quite shortly after that, you know, went to Washington and had meetings in the White House and with other officials. And it was a tough time. It was a tough time.
And is this when the idea that Carstens brings up, the bigger picture, let's get a bigger contingent, let's not keep it focused on this sort of two-on-two or one-on-one exchanges, but let's really open it up and you end up, how did that come about? Can you talk about that a little bit?
So there's here you have kind of Jake Sullivan, the National Security Advisor, who had been a bit resisting the idea of freeing Krasikov. He now sees, because he wants to be able to say we drove the best bargain we could, He now sees it. Look, the Germans have crossed this moral threshold. In his mind, Olaf Scholz has accepted the idea of freeing this guy in exchange for Navalny. And okay, Navalny's now dead, but there are no shortage of political prisoners, deserving dissidents in Russia. And if we do this carefully, we can bring out more dissidents than we plan to. So while all of us are kind of in mourning and thinking Evan's going to spend his 30s, and not only him, there's another journalist, Alsu Karmasheva from the Radio Free Europe, and Vladimir Karamurza, and these people are going to spend a decade of their lives in a Russian jail cell. Jake is seeing this possibility and getting it going. And pieces of paper are flying across the Atlantic to Germany of a list of people that maybe we could free out of Russia if we're willing to put Krasikov on the table.
Yeah.
I suppose one of the conclusions that is not particularly palatable or nice to think about is that Putin had realized, perhaps, that the Americans and the Germans had agreed to trade Navalny. And they had calculated that that agreement from the Germans about Navalny could be transferred onto other political prisoners, allowing Putin at that point to take Navalny off the board and still get what he wanted. And I think what Jake and, you know, the people in the National Security Council really realized was that in Krasikov, they understood that he was so valuable to Putin. And the closer it got to a deal, if you recall, Tucker Carlson went to do that interview with Putin, the big sort of 2-hour extravaganza. And in that, for the first time, he starts talking about Krasikov, refers to him as the patriot. So Putin himself was also signaling that he wanted to do this, but in so doing, revealing his hand slightly that this is really important to me. And I think the Americans realized that they could create a trade much bigger, hang as many people as possible off Krasikov, and that's, you know, what they ended up doing with the 16 people that came home, which is, you know, from all these different countries, something historic.
I'm interested in any observations you folks have on the difference between the Trump administration and the Biden administration on handling hostage affairs.
Do you know the big difference I see is between the Trump administration and the current Trump administration? Because the first Trump administration had no shortage of Americans who were jailed in Russia under seemingly spurious charges. There are two former Marines, Paul Whelan and Trevor Reed, both were jailed during Trump's administration for differing national security charges. And when people would bring it to Trump, he just wasn't interested. He would talk about Aesop Rocky, the rapper he tried to free from Sweden, who was detained there. John Bolton, who was national security advisor, was dead set against it. Hell no, was his words. Hell no, those words. You can imagine that. He's an old cold warrior himself. Biden took a softer approach. I think Biden genuinely liked being able to like look an American, a mom, a dad in the eye and say, your son's coming home. Now, maybe that's because of the grief he experienced in his own life. Trump, when he was back in the opposition, watching Biden free Evan and Paul Whelan and Brittany Griner and Trevor Reed and all these Americans, including some that he failed to free. I think Trump, and why we've talked to Trump's team about this, he saw the political value in this. And I think he also maybe even was personally moved by some of the stories that he heard from Americans who'd been held in Russia. So since Trump has come back, he has freed several prisoners. He's done the kind of deals he refused to do in his first term. And in that weird way, it's a point of continuity between Joe Biden and Donald Trump.
I would say there is a difference in style, which everyone would expect. With Trump, his approach to doing deals to bring hostages back is very personalized. He stripped back and bypassed a lot of the infrastructure that the Biden administration built, you know, around Spiha and Roger Carstens. He wants to deal with this directly, or he wants to deal with a special envoy like Steve Witkoff. But actually what I think, as Drew says, that people will be quite surprised by is the degree of continuity. And these conversations are still ongoing. There are more deals to be done. And I think the president was personally very moved when Mark Fogel came home. Malfine Fogel, Mark Fogel's 95-year-old mother, had appeared with him, you know, just before he went on stage at Butler, Pennsylvania. And I think when he had a conversation with Mark Fogel after he came home in the White House, in the Lincoln Room, actually, he changed his mind somewhat on bringing back as many people as he could from Russia, even if it may make him look weak in front of Vladimir Putin. And so we're seeing beneath the surface that those conversations are still definitely happening now.
So, as you mentioned, we used to have a policy in the United States government of no concessions, no negotiations with terrorists. And by the way, it's not just old cold warriors like John Bolton who, you know, fought to uphold that policy. My understanding is the Justice Department consistently, under multiple attorneys general, including Merrick Garland, Biden's attorney general, opposed these sort of deals for the simple reason that once you start doing them, there's no end. You invite, you know, all sorts of, bad characters around the world to start doing the same thing. And one could argue that's exactly what we're seeing right now. So are we better off abandoning the no concessions policy that we used to have to what we have today, which is, hey, let's negotiate. Let's see what we can work out.
You're completely right. And I would say it's not only in general, Justice Department people don't like unlocking convicts from jail. And it's not only them. There are people in the CIA who certainly feel that, like, look, giving up Victor Boot for Brittany Griner, we might as well have put like a sign up, take some more, try it again.
Yeah, the merchant of death for a basketball player.
Exactly.
I mean, yeah.
What I'd say is that there's really no, having been on multiple sides of this as a journalist covering it, as a friend of someone there, as someone, I don't think there's an easy answer. What I think has changed is that this is just how the world works now. The unipolar era where America kind of had the strength of its, 1995 was a long time ago. And it's just a reality that America has to concede to. This is not something just that Russia does. China has done it in similar ways. The other thing I'd add is that I think there's a light bulb has gone off in Putin's mind. Look at the amount of prisoners of war that Ukraine and Russia have traded. There's talk of big trades coming out of Belarus, like as we speak. I think Putin has realized this is something he can give. This is a game he can play with the Trump administration. Okay, we're not making a ton of progress on the Ukraine thing. It's always, yes, yes, we want to resolve the war, but we just have these inflexible demands. I think he's realized in the meantime, we can do some trades. We can do some other business to keep this conversation warm and give the president something he can point to.
Looking back at the Biden administration and your, as I say, a string of spy stories and wonderful portraits of these various shadowy kind of individuals that got involved in hostage negotiations. Do you think that with the Trump administration, it'll still require the use of all these go-betweens, unofficial go-betweens, or do you think Trump will be more direct about hostage negotiations?
I think that's something that has changed a little bit. I think if you could broadly say, you know, the difference between the two administrations, the Biden administration and particularly Jake Sullivan wanted to build an architecture and a structure to try and rationalize the response to this as a way of dealing with it and also as a way of deterring it, I suppose. Whereas Trump is much more, I think, on a case by case basis. And is interested in, you know, ferrying messages back and forth, either directly, because there's obviously many more like diplomatic channels open now, or through, you know, we understand it's Steve Witkoff when he goes to Moscow, you know, obviously the peace talks and those like technical points are the most important things that are on the agenda. But prisoner talks are often also a point of conversation.
I would just say, I think it's inevitable, given the complications of these deals. There's always factions that don't want to do it. Like you mentioned, the Justice Department. There's always people saying, well, what about this other idea? It just inevitably becomes a world where you have middlemen, for lack of a better word, folks who come from strange walks of life, who make it their job to go try to see the president, see the Secretary of State, who fly to Russia, see Foreign Minister Lavrov and get a deal done. Because it's not something that can happen as easy. So these are not trade deals where, you know, you send the commerce secretary to Moscow and they discuss the quality of fish that you'll be exporting. These are really complex, thorny negotiations that always need random, really random people to get.
And we can expect that the old KGB officer, Vladimir Putin, will continue to bringing back some of these illegals that he got in these swaps. And you describe very colorfully him waiting on the red carpet for one of his illegals, or his prize illegals assassin, he's going to continue running illegal deep cover operations in the West. And if they get caught, he's going to snatch somebody to get them back, because he wants to show that he'll stand by his guys when they get caught in the West.
So let me ask a follow-up question to that, which is, what do you think the lessons that Putin has learned from this are in terms of what he can do differently in the future? In terms of, so what do you, what's the
takeaway? Why should he do anything differently? Would be my question. He gets what he wants.
Wait. I think he's learned it works.
Yeah, that's what my takeaway is from you know what you've reported as well.
I know that's the problem. That's the problem with hostage diplomacy, is that it works and it plays on an asymmetric advantage that autocracies have over free societies. They don't have to worry about public pressure when their people get locked away. They don't have to worry about competing branches of the executive with the DOJ and the White House and having different perspectives and Roger Carstens. There's one decider, one man. He sits in the Kremlin and he makes these decisions with his small coterie of advisors who also happen to all come from a KGB mindset. And the KGB pioneered this. They did this during the Cold War. And I would argue that Putin's actually done it in a more kind of intensified and successful way in the trades that he's managed to execute.
There's another thing I think Putin has learned, which is there's an interesting moment in when he arrests in 2018, the FBI arrests Maria Butina, who's like, it's not even really right to call her a spy. She's just brazenly a foreign agent meeting everybody she can in Washington. And she gets arrested. And Putin, and this tracks the reporting we have, and he says it publicly, he seemed to think that she was going to get 15 to 20 years in jail, because that's what you would get in Russia. Paul Whelan got 16 years. He seems to think that. And he keeps saying that. He says it at a press conference. We spoke to people who heard him say it in different contexts. He's fixated on this idea that the West is going to do to his spies what he would do to ours. And so she pleads guilty in mid-December 2018. 2 weeks later, he sends the FSB goes and arrests Paul Whelan. And she ends up spending a year and a half she's sentenced for a year and a half and only spends like 8 months in a low security, all women's prison in Tennessee. And then she goes home to be a national hero. I think that surprised the Kremlin. And when you talk about the asymmetry, that's part of it, is that a Russian spy caught in the West knows they're facing a few years in a Norwegian prison, not the worst place. And, one and an American who's arrested on a bogus charge could spend decades in a place like, you know, a penal colony.
You'd have to say that it's crazy for an American to go to Russia these days.
Yeah. I'm really sorry to say that, because I really, you know, Joe and I got into this business of being foreign reporters, not to tell people, hey, the world's a scary place. Don't go to Russia. A fascinating country. It's, you know, we're in the business of telling people about what the world is like, and that maybe you can learn something from other countries. But in this one case, when you jail basketball players, reporters, all kinds of ordinary travelers, history teachers, then it becomes, I have to say that no, now is not a great time to visit this fascinating, important country called Russia.
So just to wrap up here, I want to come back to what I thought was one of the most astonishing sentences in your book. Early on, the number of U.S. citizens held hostage around the world was growing so fast, the Biden administration had declared it a national emergency. And so this, it takes me back to my question, are we better off today than we were before when we had an absolute rule against doing these kind of deals? Because it seems like if the numbers are growing so fast, that's a pretty good indicator that what we're doing now ain't working and it ain't stopping this like mad dash to abduct innocent citizens around the world.
Well, the trouble is we're living in this new world. And we're living in a world where autocrats are looking for any leverage they can against America. And taking hostages for political leverage is incredibly effective, as we've said. And although Putin is the primary practitioner of this, this is also being done in Venezuela, in Iran, by China, by North Korea. We're all familiar with the cases, but when you start to put the data points together, what you may not be aware of is that inside the State Department, they actually have a categorization. It's called Classification D. The countries where kidnap or arrest is now a risk. And by population, the countries that actually where classification D countries that have become classification D countries, it amounts to a fifth of the world's population. Now, this is an incredibly dispiriting, you know, factoid. And, you know, especially when I think probably everyone on this call is, interested in traveling and exploring and, you know, the kind of transfer of information and education. But this doesn't look like something which is going to go away anytime soon, because we're, as the book says in the deck, we're in a new Cold War. And this is one of the tools that has been seen to be most effective. So everybody needs to take their traveling just a little bit more seriously now, unfortunately.
For sure. And on that droll note, we have to wrap this up. And we've just skimmed the surface here, as I said at the top of the show. There's a whole bunch of just fascinating spy stories and these interesting characters. We didn't even get to discuss somebody I wanted to talk about, this guy you call Stas, a Russian security consultant with connections to the GRU, who plays a key role in some of these swaps. And he's just one of the many colorful characters in your story. I hope a lot of people will go find your book, Swap, A Secret History of the New Cold War, and read it. You won't be sorry. Thanks again, Joe and Drew.
Thank you, Jeff.
Thanks so much for having
us. Thank you.
Thank you.
And that's it for this week's Spy Talk. Be sure to check out our complete podcast archive on Apple or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you haven't done so already, do check out the spytalk.co news site on Substack, where we offer a steady diet of scoops and original analyses on the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, and military operations. Just Google Spy Talk and you'll quickly find your way there. This edition of the Spy Talk podcast was smoothly produced, as always, by Kanai and edited by Molly Hawkey for MSW Media. And so that's it for now. I'm Jeff Stein.
I'm Michael Isgoff.
And I'm Karen Greenberg.
See you next time.
For more original reporting and insights like this, subscribe to SpyTalk.co on Substack and follow us on Twitter at @talk_spy. If you enjoyed our podcast, subscribe and leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
MSW Media.
Care Talk with Laura Packard is a podcast covering healthcare in America from a progressive perspective. Our healthcare system is broken, and we all know insurance companies are out of control. If you don't have health insurance or don't understand the differences between insurance plans or have surprise medical bills, out-of-control prescription drug costs, or can't get the care you need, listen to Care Talk with Laura Packard weekly on Tuesdays. What's going to happen to your healthcare under the Trump administration? From prescription drug prices to health insurance costs, from healthcare for seniors and people with disabilities to reproductive care, from care for veterans to public health, including vaccinations. Healthcare experts answer your questions every week, and they go in-depth on Medicare, Medicaid, the Affordable Care Act, private insurance, and more. Go to healthcarevoices.org/caretalk or search for Care Talk with Laura Packard on your favorite podcast app to listen today.